As always, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by my company, Horns of Odin. We've recently had a huge restocking on all of our leather and ironwork, including our Milner pendants, horn stands, and leather rune horn belt hangers. And all items are handmade in the UK. Head over to www.hornsofodin.com to check out our full range. Don't forget to use the code HORNS10 to grab 10% off store-wide. That's code HORNS10 as exclusive to you listeners of the podcast. I'm genuinely really excited to introduce our latest sponsor. As a self-confessed giant comic book nerd, I'm so happy that we've been able to team up with Things From Another World. If, like me, you've been missing out on Comic Cons this year, then Things From Another World have you covered. So Things From Another World offer over 30,000 pop culture products with thousands of comics, toys, statues, apparel, graphic novels, and tons of other collectibles. They have a huge variety of products from hundreds of manufacturers, including DC Direct, Dark Horse, Hasbro, McFarlane, Marvel, Tokyo Pop, Master Replicas, Disney, and much, much more. If that's not enough, they carry the full Diamond Distributor catalogue, so you can pick up the latest titles as soon as they hit the shelves, and also they ship worldwide. So head over to their website by clicking on the link in the show notes and find the perfect gift for a loved one or a cheeky little treat for yourself. Remember to click the link in the show notes so they know that we sent you. Right, let's get into the show. And welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farren, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin. And as always, I'm joined by Dr. Matthias Nordvig.
Hello, everyone. Today we have a really interesting guest. We have Jack Donovan, the author of The Way of Men, on a podcast. We're going to talk with Jack about basically using the past as a way to, becoming a man. We're going to talk about masculinity, of course, in context of Scandinavia. But Jack, as I understand you, you're also you're a little broader than simply just Germanic Scandinavia. You're focused on sort of more the Indo-European background. Nonetheless, welcome to the show. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of fun conversations for us to have.
Sure.
So yeah, let's get the ugly stuff out of the way first, I guess, because as we're kind of getting ahead of the curve, we assume that when we put this out, we're probably going to get some negative comments, as you're probably the most controversial guest we've had so far. And I guess that's some people call you right wing, some people call you alt-right. And I just want to give you a chance in your own words to kind of say what you've got to say about that, and then we can put that to bed and move on to the masculinity side of stuff.
Yeah, well, as you said, internet will say I'm a bad man. Basically, when I wrote The Way of Men, I was obviously looking at masculinity and saying, what is masculinity about? And what defines masculinity? What do men care about? And one of the main thesis of that book was that the way of men is the way of the gang, and that men actually select each other. And a lot of evolutionary psychologists actually missed that. But if you do, in the way that men select each other for a football team, and then the foot guys on the football team get the girl, it's very much the same concept if you think about it. Because if you couldn't pull your own weight in a band of men who are struggling to survive, you aren't worth a lot as a man. And so men have always cared what other men thought about them, because they had to, from a survival perspective. And that's most of our evolutionary history. And so the way of men is the way of the gang. And I start, obviously going down this thought process. I'm like, well, what is tribe? What are my people? Who am I? Where do I fit in? What are my people? Whatever. And so, I looked into that in a lot of different ways. And I looked into race and culture and all that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of people, when I first started writing about it, it was more like the West, and so you're like, well, what is my real heritage? And that's why, I mean, really a lot of people, I think, get into, you know, whether they're, you know, Scandinavian religion in some way, or Germanic religion, or any of these other ones, a lot of them are interested in their heritage. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes an issue. And then, so when I wrote The Way of Men, yeah, obviously a lot of people who were also interested in a lot of the different, the same ideas, were interested in my work. And I've always been of the mind, kind of a Hunter S. Thompson kind of character, in the sense of like, well, I can talk to all kinds of people with all kinds of different ideas. And that's actually the America where I grew up in. We don't really live in that world right now, because people live in a world of gossip. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you hang out with one person, then you believe everything that they've ever believed in their entire life. And, you know, I don't believe what I believed 3 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever. You know, people want to put me in a box, like say, hey, you're this or that or whatever. I also voted for John Kerry, the Democratic candidate in San Francisco, with my Mexican boyfriend. So what box would you, what period of my life are we talking about that puts me into where, you know, who this guy is? But anyway, yeah, obviously I spoke at some alt-right events. I spoke at some, I did a Tarian events in Europe, which Europe, I think, is a different thing. I don't even deal with that because I don't know what's going on there. I don't speak the languages. You know, if they want to publish my books, I'm like, cool. You know, like, mm-hmm. You're going to pay to publish my books? That's great. I don't know what you're publishing, and there's no way I can judge it because I don't speak German and Italian and all that stuff. So anyway, obviously the next thing, the next sin that I've done is that I was in a folkish heathen group. And obviously in the world of heathenry and Odinism and all this, and Asatru and all that, there's, you know, there's kind of this folkish camp, and there's, you know, like a universalist camp. And so I joined a folkish group. Now, was it a hate group that was excited about going out and hurting other people? No, and that we never talked about that. But it was limited because it was people concerned about their heritage. Mm-hmm. I'm not part of that group anymore. It didn't work out. And actually, I found that personally very limited. And as Matthias said at the beginning of the podcast, you know, I'm looking to broaden my perspective, because when I wrote The Way of Men, I wrote about, you know, I used the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I used the story of Rome, and I used all these things to talk about these things that are important to men everywhere, all around the world, no matter what race they are, no matter what culture and whatever. And right now, that's kind of what I'm working on, is I'm kind of going back to my roots, because I felt very limited by only being able to deal with people who were into, you know, this Germanic thing. We're only people into the Scandinavian thing. We're only people into this or that. And I just want to deal with excellent guys, and who care about excellence and strength and all the other ideas that I talk about. So I'm more interested in the principles that unify them. And so that's what I'm writing about now, and that's what I care about now.
No, perfect. And, you know, I feel awkward that you even had to kind of go through that, but we, like you say, we live in this world where people do put people in boxes, and as soon as we release episodes, you're going to get a certain group of people who are going to automatically see your name and assume things. And I think it helps. It helps all around that we can just say, look, listen to the first 6 minutes of the show, and that will explain kind of where we're at. And, you know, you like it or you don't like it. And, you know, like you said yourself, people change their opinions, people change their minds. And I worry more about the people who refuse to change their minds on things and always stick with the same opinions for 30 years. They're the people I worry more than somebody who says, you know what, did that, this isn't for me, so now I do this. Or I did that, I've learned from that, so now I do something else. And they're the people who are willing to learn and change, and they're the kind of, for me, the more trustworthy people.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't admit you're ever wrong, or that you ever made a mistake, or that you ever, you know, that your ideas are evolved, I mean, you're actually not a thinker. You know, you're not a conscious person. You're not self-aware. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, or you're just doubling down, and people do this too. They'll just double down on a bad idea and they never let it go, you know, and that's terrible too. And, you know, the people who would make these comments, I always wonder, like, are they, you know, I don't do that. I don't go out and be like, you talked to a bad person once. You know, like, who does that? Like, it's just gossip. It's like a way to feel better than somebody without actually accomplishing anything in life. So anyway, so let's go to the good stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we say good stuff, but Matthias, obviously we had a little bit of feedback from our last episode.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we, oh, yeah. So what was it? We were called liberal Jewish cucks and stuff like that for the last episode that we had. Yeah. Yeah, that was amazing.
So, yeah, for anybody who hasn't listened to the last episode, it was the one where we had a conversation about whether or not the possibility of there being homosexual Vikings. And some people didn't like that idea and decided to call us liberal Jewish cooks.
Yeah, and pushing an ideology and I don't know what. Yeah, no, that was interesting. Obviously, one of the things that came out of that conversation that we had with Amy last time was actually that we wanted to hear, and that's why we, you know, have invited you on the show, Jack. We wanted to hear about masculinity as a concept in and of itself in that context. So, yeah, where should we start?
I guess the obvious link for me, because like I say, a lot of the negative comments came directly to me through the business page. Mm-hmm. So the comments that we were picking up on, I guess, were, you know, how can there be gay Vikings when kind of like you are quote unquote effeminate if you are gay? So how can you be the kind of this big brute masculine Viking going around? And some people even said, you know, they were known for their raping, and you know that was kind of thrown at us a lot. So I guess the obvious question, you know, as you said, Jack, before, you've got your a Mexican boyfriend. You don't hide that, you know. So, but also anybody watching the video podcast can also see that you are kind of a pinnacle of masculine man. You know, you are not the stereotype effeminate male that, you know, these people are quoting. So I want to get your opinion on the way that they were looking at it, this idea of that a gay man couldn't be a Viking because they are not masculine.
Well, first of all, I would think it was very interesting, and I don't think this is necessarily the case, but I would think it was very interesting if the people who were mad about potential racism were okay with saying that all homosexuals are effeminate. That would be interesting that they're doing the same thing. Now, whether they're two different groups, again, like I said, you have two different groups in that world. One is very accepting, and the other one is very like, well, you're a liberal Jewish cuck. and I get all those emails, and that's why, I mean, honestly, the white nationalists and all those people, I hate them more than anyone at this point, because I get more shitty email from them than anybody else. Like the far left, like, leaves me alone compared to the far right. They're just angry, shitty people.
You're kind of stuck in the middle, hated by both.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that means that you're doing something right. You're thinking. Yeah. But, as far as there being, homosexuality, masculinity, and the possibility of that existing, well, of course it did. The thing is that historically, and I obviously put a lot of study into this at a certain time in my life. Historically, there's probably always been, in every culture, everywhere, there's a very small percentage of homosexuality that happens. It's just a recurring thing. It's like in the way that there are different personality traits that come out everywhere over and over again. And some people are like this, and some people are like that, and some people are like that. We don't really know why, but it is a thing that happens. And what's funny is the idea that it couldn't be Vikings would be like, actually, sailors have a pretty big reputation for that in the world.
We suggested that one. That was one of the sticking points that a lot of people kind of attacked us for as well, was this, well, how dare you say that this war band of people, just because they hung out together, made them all gay. And it's like, yeah. No, what?
It didn't make them all gay, but I think that, you know, Bjorn and Thor, you know, have been on a boat for 9 months, and you're like, Hey, how you doing, Bjorn? You know, like I did it ever happen? Sure, it probably happened. Was it a social norm? Probably not. Yeah. You know, because I think that happens more often in very cosmopolitan areas, because you have a very small percentage of the population that has that is different in some way. And in a very big city, they can all find each other. Mm-hmm. But, if you have small country towns and whatever, you're not going to have a bunch of that. Or, dude is going to make a messed up move and everybody in the town's, maybe going to burn him, or something, it's, mm-hmm. if he makes the wrong move, because that's, you can overstep in that Absolutely. World, obviously. And so that could be a problem. But, in more cosmopolitan areas, I mean, that's why, and obviously it was a thing in ancient Greece. But I've always thought, I was like, I bet that didn't happen in the countryside so much. But in downtown Athens, yeah, that probably went on. But did it happen in the countryside? I don't know. The same thing is true of Rome. I mean, there's no reason to suggest that it probably didn't happen. But like I said, it was probably, as long as you're talking about small groups of people, it was probably not all the time.
No,
it would be unusual, and of course they wouldn't be like getting gay married and doing stuff like that. I mean, they wouldn't, that wouldn't exist in that frame.
No.
So
I actually think that's really interesting what you just said about how it's more common in kind of like the cosmopolitan areas.
Yeah,
I'd never really thought of it like that, and I guess it's because back 1,000 years ago, maybe even back 50 years ago, it was a dangerous move to come out and come on to another man, not knowing whether or not it's going to be received well, or you're going to get, a kicking once you leave the area. And I never really looked at it from that perspective before.
Well, actually, I mean, to be honest, I mean, if you've studied the culture, that's why it's really hilarious, is because where that used to happen a lot was, at ports with sailors, back in the day, it's well known, Jean Genet was a famous French writer who used to write about that, about like getting down with criminals and like it and whatever in the, ports and so forth in France and whatever. Cause these guys are traveling all around the world and they're in there for a minute. Nobody knows what they're doing. They can go back home. Nobody knows about it. It's fine.
No, this is really interesting, because this is actually an example when I briefly address these subjects when I teach about Vikings, for instance, in classes. We talk about the fact that if you read Icelandic sagas, what you'll encounter is a lot of what you could basically call homophobia. They're really, really in the stories. They're really afraid of being called homosexuals, and that would then merit a response that would end up with somebody getting killed and at the bare minimum at least outlaw, right? So that tells us then that, well, when people are writing down sagas in Iceland, the cultural norm is
sure.
very much anti-homosexuals. And we don't know if that's a trait of post-conversion Iceland, so that the Christianity plays a role. We don't know if it's a trait of Iceland as a society in and of itself. That could be a part of the deal as well. And we don't know what it looked like in Scandinavia, say in the Viking Age. We have very, very little to go on in general when it comes to evidence of people's attitudes to sexuality. Except we, of course, know that they practiced heterosexual sex and got married, right? That we know these two things, but that's it. So this is really interesting, because we have in southern Denmark in the Viking Age, we have the largest urban community. And I would say to my students, for instance, if there's anything, any place that's going to have a community of people who practice homosexual sex, it's probably going to be such a urban, quote-unquote urban here. We're not dealing with, big cities at all. It's a couple of thousand people maximum, right? But that's probably where we would find it. And because that's also where the ships come in. That's where the traders come in. That's where people come and go all the time. So no, it makes perfect sense to me. It is interesting, though, that Iceland is so really incredibly scared about talking about it and dealing with it in general. It's very obvious that Iceland as a society in the Viking Age and early medieval period is established on a very very like single-lined idea of what it means to be male. And if you break that, then you're screwed. Like, seriously. you lose your possession, you lose your position, you lose your access to anything, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is interesting, though, because, you know, we're talking about like the written and spoken word, you know, like what you'd write down about your society versus what actually goes on. And you never really know. You know, because if no one had been writing down all the other stuff that went on, you probably, like, the main people in society be like, no, there's none of that there. There's this great video, actually, by this guy who does videos about Ireland, like, there are no gays in Ireland. And absolutely not. You know, the singing men, the dancing men. It's hilarious. But, there's going to be a main line about what people are comfortable to, like, this is what we want to promote. And that's always going to be pretty much the same, you know, like, obviously you're going to promote things that are in service of the family and all that. When you're talking about, like, you know, like a theater, I mean, cause we're talking about stories, right? I mean, you're talking about the sagas. So we're talking about stories. Even the way that we write now, and it's like, there's so, as we talked about when you were on my podcast, there's a lot less information than there is about, you know, other cultures. And, I forget what I was going to say, but there's this. Oh yeah. The other thing that people get this from, and this is more the folkish side, they get it from, the Roman who wrote about, I'm having a blank on his name.
Tacitus,
yes. Tacitus has one line in there about that, which could be interpreted. It's like in flagrante delicto or something like that. It's one line that could be interpreted a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the bog people.
Yeah.
And from those two things, people have decided that all tribes everywhere in the Germanic world for thousands of years drown homosexuals in bogs.
Yes.
And people have come to that conclusion, but the evidence really isn't there for that. You know, I mean, maybe in that tribe they did, in that tribe they didn't. We don't know.
Exactly.
No, it's good that you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you about that anyway, Mateus, because obviously, again, that was the one thing that people kept saying on, you know, on the post. It was, well, they threw them in the bog. People would just comment bog. And it was just kind of like over and over. And I'm like, right, okay. So Amy actually came on and said about how that was wrong, and it's more of a kind of a Nazi propaganda. So I wanted to ask you, Mateus, about that and how much truth there is to it, what there is, and I know you'll tell us the facts.
No, this is really interesting, because this is actually an example when I briefly address these subjects when I teach about Vikings, for instance, in classes. We talk about the fact that, like, if you read Icelandic sagas, what you'll encounter is a lot of
maybe just give a quick outline on what the bog bodies actually are for people who aren't familiar.
They're human beings who have been killed and put in lakes, and then they sink to the bottom, and then sediment layers will basically enclose them in an oxygen-free environment. The tannins of the sediment layers at the bottom of the bog will make sure to preserve your skin and your hair. They preserve so much of the body. Obviously, the bones will be dissolved because it's very acidous environment. But to some extent, you get such good preservation that you can even analyze the content of these people's stomachs and see what did they eat before they went into the bog. Now, we have men and women found in, you know, as like just a single person, some in some cases a couple of people, and they are from all the way back from the Bronze Age, some of them, as far as I remember, but primarily from the Iron Age. So the first 500 years of the first millennium CE. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, that they actually exhibit very many different styles of what you could call sacrifice or killing. Some have been seems to have been hung and hacked at or stabbed or had some kind of violent death, and others might have been choked by a person using a string to choke them. There's one in particular, I can't remember which, what this one is called, but that person, which is I think is a female, has her thumb between her index finger and the next finger. As she's lying there, we don't know if that's like a symbol or if it's an ancient way of saying fuck you or whatever it is. But there are plenty of like theories.
Is that like where they used to put the balls in your mouth?
Yeah, I guess so. I have no idea. And the same is the case with, like, you know, some go in with items, some go in naked, some have clothes on, and so it's, there's like a whole variety when it comes to these bog bodies. But so that single line that Jack was referring to, the in Tacitus, is what has basically prompted, especially Nazi scholars back in the early 20th century. To suggest, oh well, this is of course how they dealt with homosexuals and criminals and so on. And I believe the last person to sort of echo this theory is Vak Vikanes in his book on Germanic mythology and worldview, whatever it's called in English. I actually don't know the title that well. I read it back, you know, ages ago, and it was crap. that seems to be where this comes from. It's, you know, it's an old theory on how they might have dealt with the deviants in society, basically.
Do they all tend to be executions then?
Well, so this is the thing. Some of them definitely look like executions. Some of them look like maybe just murders, and some of them look like sacrifices. And it might actually be the whole range. You know, Denmark is a country with a lot of water. You know, if you want to get rid of a body, that's what you do. You know, you put them in the local bog over there.
It wasn't the Vikings, it was the mafia. They were there.
It was the mob.
I often wondered what you'd find if you drained the Thames in London.
Right?
I mean, I bet you would find some wonderful things and some horrific things as well.
Yeah. And see, this is the thing too, you know, from the Viking Age, where, from some of the city environments, what we find is like a well where, you know, somebody dumped a body. That does occur. We found a well, I think in one of the ring fortresses called the Trelleborg fortresses, that has a head and a hand. And I think a child's skeleton in it as well. And like, we don't know if that's some kind of like ritualistic act or if it's just, you know, somebody who tried to poison the well or somebody who needed to get rid of some guy's head and their hand, you know.
Well, that's it. It's a completely different time. They didn't have the police team and the scuba diving units who could go down there and search the bottom of the lake. So like you say, you could easily just throw somebody in there and nobody's going to know unless they float back to the top.
Yeah. And, you know, naturally, as a mythologist, somebody who researches mythology, I'm thinking, okay, we got a head in a well here. That's got to be some kind of Odin shit going on here. Maybe the hand, something to do with Tyr. But who knows?
Of course, you've got to think like that. So, I mean, moving on, let's jump into kind of like masculinity within Norse mythology. I know you two touched on this a little bit in your podcast as well, Jack. and how what it means to be a man, I guess, in the Viking Age.
Well, I think that's more of a Matthias area than mine.
Well, you know, what does it mean to be a man in the Viking Age? Obviously, the standard is a man who owns his own house, his own little plot of land, has a wife, and has children as well. That I think is sort of like the standard idea of what a man is. Now, of course, this man also needs to have qualities and skills. Otherwise, he's not working out. If you go to the poem Rigsdula, or the what is it called, Rig's Journey in English, where it's a late poem, but nonetheless, it gives us some ideas about what sort of like the middle of the road working class man is like. He's a man who plows the field and knows all of these crafts and knows how to work the land and build his own house. So I feel like that actually sounds very similar to a modern man, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my thesis, is that there's things that come out of the humanities in universities that, a study of masculinities in the plural is it, meaning that it's never been the same, is their basic theory, is that it's never been the same and it's always changing. And so you can't really define masculinity, but if you really go through most of history, you really can. It's usually very specific. And that's what the Way of Men was about. I mean, there are very specific virtues that usually have to do with, well, you know, what good is this guy in a group of dudes, you know? And mm-hmm. then obviously in a bigger community, then there's things like, Matthias was saying, as far as like, you know, does he own a house? You know, and it's all these things of like carrying your own weight, really. Like, is he on his own or is he dependent? I mean, because that's, you know, like it's traditionally been okay for women to be dependent in most societies because they have children and that's kind of part of their job and that's their contribution. But, for men, if a man's not independent at a certain age, he's like a child, and they can't, you know, he becomes a burden to everyone around him. And so, yeah, everywhere and always men have been expected to carry their own weight and to be producers instead of, you know, just consumers. And, and obviously, like I was talking about the book, you know, like strength, tell me the culture that said strength, that the weaker man is the more masculine man. That's not part of any culture. Things like courage, the cowardly man, he's clearly the more masculine man. I mean, that never happens, you know, anywhere in the world, you know? So, I mean, there's just things that have always been associated with masculinity because they have to do with our primal role as men and that men have always wanted to be, to emulate that and to be seen as a man by other men.
And that's, you know, that makes a lot of sense to consider, you know. The biological makeup of humans across the planet is pretty similar. So in that sense, we could also assume that, you know, there are only so many variations that you get in the interpretation of what our biology as male or female is going to be, right? That makes a lot of sense, and I think that, you know, we see this expressed very clearly in the Scandinavian literature too. This point you were making with the man who doesn't, you know, become independent at some point, at a certain age he's supposed to be independent. I mean, there are themes about this in the folklore. We call them the Ashlad, Askeladden in Norwegian. So this is the guy who hangs out in front of the fire all the time, hence Ashlad. And the folk tales are about that guy becoming a man. So it was obviously a theme that was important to address in an earlier Scandinavian culture. And this theme seems to have existed for thousands of years, actually, in folk tales. Obviously, the latest iterations from the 19th century, that's the ones that we have. But yeah, he does exist as a figure. I'm obviously not familiar with all kinds of folk tales out there, but I'm sure it's a theme globally.
Yeah, I mean, coming of age stories, you know, like obviously, what does a man do? When, at what point does he become a man? Obviously, there's a huge tradition, and there's tons of writing about, you know, rituals that's been a big thing since the 90s, as far as like men don't have rituals anymore that take them from being a boy to a man. Because what I've always said about that is the reason we don't is because we don't have a cultural consensus about what being a man is.
Mm.
You can't really initiate them into something that you don't know what it is. And whereas before, if you had like a small village or you had a society that was very culturally homogenous, they all have the same expectations of what that guy is supposed to do. And so when you have a ritual to be manhood, okay, now you're a man. This is your job now. This is what your responsibilities are. This is what your expectations are. The boy is dead, because they always go through this death process. Like, the boy is dead, you know, the man is born. And you have to go through this. I mean, and that's the same again all around the world. The book that you know, one of the books that I've been reading recently that goes through the initiation process is from Africa. You know, mm-hmm. like they studied a lot of tribes in Africa, and they do the exact same thing. It's usually like a circumcision ritual or whatever, and they die, and everybody tells their family that they were eaten by monsters, and then they rise from now they have to be men.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same thing always and everywhere.
Yeah. Is that Victor Turner that you've been reading?
Yes. Yeah. Great. And actually, Mircea Eliade actually wrote a whole book about initiation as well.
Which is pretty good.
So do you think that masculinity can change through different time periods, or what it means to be a man? I guess for the longest time, you know, we lived in warrior tribes, we were a warrior culture, and you know, you had to have that kind of like pinnacle, strong, masculine man, that archetypal figure. Whereas now in modern times, I guess that isn't needed anymore. We're not warrior culture anymore. So does the definition of masculinity change from then to now, as I guess you can still be a provider in the sense of kind of that masculine provider, but you don't have to be a warrior or a fighter. You could just be a really good computer coder and still provide for your family's, you know, more than adequately.
Well, yeah, 100%. I mean, the superficial cultural aspects of it always change. I think there's the root of what masculinity is, that it's primal and it's part of being human. That, you know, in the same way, I always say, like, we talk about evolutionary psychology. People have sex even though they know that they don't want to create babies. Right? Yeah. Well, why do you want to have sex? It's not logical. it's a terrible waste of resources and time. Our evolutionary brains still want to do that. You know, even though we're using birth control, we're not having babies, we're doing whatever. But there's something about us that still wants to do that thing. And in the same way, I think masculinity is very much the same way. It's like there is a part of men that is always there that wants to identify with that warrior thing, because that's what we've been for so long. The hunting and fighting gang. Now, is that all of masculinity? No. And that's why I think, you know, I've talked about it briefly, and this is kind of what my new book is about, that, you can break it into different roles. We had a funny discussion about it, Matthias, on my podcast, but there are three, you know, the three main gods, like in the Norse pantheon. You have like, you know, you have your Odin, and you have your Thor, which is more like a traditional warrior character, Dumnezeu's second function. And then you have, you know, like Frey, which he said that was maybe tacked on later, but that's okay. Because most men are not warriors all their lives. Even men who are warriors, if they don't die, they come home and work at farms, you know, and they get to the process of raising families and taking care of life and perpetuating life. And so that's always been a part of what masculinity is as well. So, you know, is that warrior part does it always have to be there? I think yes. I think that there's something in masculinity, and this upsets people, but there's something in masculinity that is always going to be attached to a threat of violence. It's there. It has to be there. Otherwise, you're talking about something else then. But are there many other aspects of masculinity? Absolutely.
Do you think that warrior side could morph in modern day into something other than necessarily violence? It could just be maybe that you are the more hungry in your situation and you just want to get ahead of the others. It doesn't have to necessarily be a violent way. It could be you in the office space, you know, you've got that drive to be the best and get ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, like the other circles that I run in that I really actually go in, you know, like the men's circles, obviously there's the, like the being alpha thing. And, you know, obviously they're not talking about chopping heads off. They're talking about, like, you know, doing what you have to do and being hungry for success and all that kind of thing. And obviously, yeah, I mean, that's where aggression is channeled into. I think it's bad to deny where the root of it comes from, but obviously we can't all be warriors. You know, even in the scariest society, everybody's not a warrior. And certainly in this one, you know, that's just a job that also men still do. There are still warriors and police. That is a job that men still do. It's not like it's gone away. It's just we farm it out to a very small percentage of men, which may grow and change at different times, depending on what's going on in the world. So, I mean, a lot more men may be in a position where they have to worry about things that they didn't have to worry about in the very near future. So it's a mistake to say that we're going to evolve away from it and into a completely protected species, because maybe that won't happen. You know, we've stayed a very similar way for a very long time, because things don't always work out the way people want them to.
Well, I mean, that's one of the interesting things when it comes to humans. It seems like the biggest population control is actually a war. We don't have that many predators that actually really threaten us in terms of our existence. Usually, you know, historically, we've seen when humans move into an area where there haven't been humans living for at least a while, all the big animals die, especially the apex predators. They just disappear. And, you know, the Rocky Mountains where I'm sitting is like one of the last places where you still have some apex predators in sort of what we could call the Western world, right? Obviously, there's still jungles and stuff out there. But yeah, and you see, as we are getting closer and closer to the mountains here, these larger animals, they're getting more and more cramped too, because we humans, we're the ones who are killing them off in one way or another.
Let's take a moment to hear from another new sponsor, Idle Sleep. Idle Sleep are one of the top mattress companies in the USA. They're so confident in their mattresses that they offer an unprecedented 18-month risk-free trial. That's a massive 548 days. That means you can try it out for 547 days and still be entitled to send it back and get your money back. That's five times longer than the other top competitors. No matter whether you like a soft or firm mattress, Idle Sleep have got you covered. Their mattresses incorporate AirCell gel memory foam, ensuring that you stay cool and comfortable all night long. And right now, Idle Sleep are running a huge fall sale and are offering a whopping 20% off store-wide with the code FALL20. That's FALL20. Click the link in the show notes to check out their full range of products and enjoy a great night's sleep. Remember to click the link in the show notes so they know that we sent you. Right, where were we?
Have you read the book Sapiens?
I flipped through it, yeah.
So I would say there's an interesting theory in that about why humans tend to do what we do. And it's to do with how we evolved so rapidly from being kind of a mediocre species that nobody really worried about. And that's how they describe it. Yeah, and then something along the line propelled us to the top, but nature didn't have time to counteract it and put a predator in place to keep us in check. So whereas obviously everything else has something that will keep it in its place, whereas we went to the top, but because we rose so rapidly, there's like an innate feeling within humans where we're too worried that we're going to go back to being this mediocre species. So we kind of subconsciously destroy everything else. And I thought it was a really interesting theory kind of that came out of the book.
Well, you know, when the aliens come, you know, then the aliens come, then there will be the mediocre species again. That's what we're trying to get the technology there to fight the aliens, you know, like, you know, I don't know.
Didn't they just land in New Jersey? I think I saw something about that.
Is that, I mean, is it that month now?
You know, yeah, I think so.
No, I think the newest was that there's some species on, is it Jupiter or something?
Venus.
Some sort of bacteria. Yeah. So that's the new one to scare everybody.
Yeah, okay. Of course. But no, I mean, if we go back to this, notion that basically the only thing that really keeps our populations in check is us attacking ourselves as human beings, right? That's really interesting to consider that there is, if there is a base of like, I don't know if it's a need or it's a biological drive towards violence. I mean, think about that for a second. If our species harbors that in itself, and I think we see in general a lot of examples of this across the world, right? As human beings, we find some random excuse to start antagonizing another group, like whether it's a religion or race or the fact that they just live right over there on the other side of the hill, right? I mean, anybody who has lived in a small town knows how you just hate the people from that other small town right over there. They suck. That's where you go to pick fights at the bar and that kind of stuff, right?
So it tends to be sport-based.
Yeah, sports, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. So it does seem like there's something inherent in our biology that drives us towards that kind of stuff, like basic violence, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty normal to a lot of species, really. I mean, it's basic tribalism, you know. But I mean, my dogs, once I got two dogs, they packed up and now they're mean to other dogs. You know, like it's humans do that too. We get into groups and it's very normal to our psychology because, you know, there's that theory, Dunbar's number, I think is what it's called. There's that theory that we can't really have meaningful relationships beyond like 150. And so everything gets really abstract and it becomes really hard to, you know, because you can't care about it. And that's a point that I've made that I get in trouble for, but, it's true. You can't actually care about everybody in the world. Like that's impossible. I really can't even visualize anything beyond like a football stadium. And so like, you know, we do tend to like prefer groups of like-minded people, you know, and you can see that, you know, like I'm moving away from Portland because it is so culturally homogenous. It's actually so culturally homogenous that everyone there basically thinks that everybody else believes the same thing. And they're in this little bubble and they don't like even like going out into the country. They start judging people out in the country. Like, oh, you know, like all these people are bad, you know, whatever. They live in this space where everybody has the exact same opinion about things. And then they don't like the rest of the world. And you can see that happening in a lot of major cities and so forth. And so it's not like something that only happens on one side. It's not that only happens. It happens everywhere. People are tribal. Mm-hmm. And actually you mentioned to me about Sebastian Younger's book Tribe, I think, mm-hmm. We were discussing it because he wrote about that a little bit. My take on his book is basically that it was a little bit milquetoast, that he basically just said we should all be nicer to each other after saying that we really are a tribal species. We're like, well, we should all be nicer to each other. That really doesn't solve the problem that we're talking about. Humans are always going to be tribal, and that's why I personally, I've always said, smaller governments are better governments. Smaller countries are better countries. You know, like let small groups of people self. I mean, that was kind of the original idea of America. Then it just got big and out of control. Is self-determination. Hmm. You know, like really, they were supposed to have 13 colonies that were pretty much had their own say. And I'm reading the biography of George Washington and he's going up into the North with the, you know, like the Massachusetts and all these, like they don't like the guys from Massachusetts. The guys from Virginia hate the guys from Massachusetts. And like, they're having all kinds of cultural problems there. And that's always been the way it is. And so I think I think that's the way the world is. And you know, like Dr. Strangelove, we should stop worrying and learn to love the bomb. Like we should learn to love. I mean, this is what we are. And so the best thing to do, I think, is to let people self-determinate instead of trying to set policy for like a continent, you know, you know, like that's, I think because people feel unimportant. Mm. You know, like they don't feel like they're being heard, and they feel like their culture is being missed, and they don't feel like they can develop beyond that. But we have this idea that we have to impose the exact same values across the entire world all the time. You know, like let's just let people be what it is. Like, you know, like let the South be the South. The South is the South. You know, like let's, you know, like, I mean, you know, in the UK, you guys have had countries that have been trying to break off for forever. they just let us be us and let us do our own thing. And, you know, there's this desire to keep everybody packed together. And I just let these groups go, let them self-determine and let them create their own cultures. And maybe you don't like their culture or maybe you'll like that culture better. I always thought if Texas broke away, I would just move there. That sounds great. I'm moving to Texas. There's so many little movements of people in America that are trying to do that, but they just never get any traction because there's so much money. But in Europe, I think there's actually more ability for those groups to kind of separate and you know, make solutions. And actually, one of the reasons, I guess I'm on a tangent now, but one of the reasons why it's such a good thing, I mean, if you look at, the virus thing, that, you know, people, it's like everybody handled it differently. Mm-hmm. And if you have completely open borders and you have nowhere you can lock anything down, you have a problem. You know, like you, if you have, hey, this group's going to try it this way and this group's going to try it this way. And over time, you're going to be like, well, they handled it better over there. You know, like, yeah. So let's do that next time. You know, but if you have everybody doing the same blanket solution, you know, you don't learn anything. You know, because it's just like no one will ever admit that they were wrong. So like, different people with different solutions trying different things. I mean, that's what human cultures are. And that's why it's cool. I want to travel to different countries where they're different.
Right. You know? That makes sense. But then let me ask you a question. What about collaborations then? You know, obviously, Russia, if we look at Russia, Russia is a federation of in principle, autonomous republics and then Russia as its own thing, right? And that seems, at least, I know very little about Russia, actually, but it seems from the outside that it's a very cohesive unit. And then you have Europe, all of these small states, right? The only way that Europe is managing their relationship to Russia and Russia's interests is through collaboration in the EU system. There's a lot of things to say about EU as an entity, whether or not you like it. That's another discussion. But that's a way that the, you know, collaboration can function, right? Mm-hmm. Sure. The US is in principle the same, a union of states that are then supposed to collaborate, right? But what we have here in the US is a much broader, more hands-on federal government than the collaborative federal government or whatever you want to call the EU system, right? And then you have I consider it more hierarchical federation of Russia, right? So it kind of seems like in order to survive and not be gobbled up by some entity, some bigger entity, right? You're going to have to try to submit somewhere. Look at Norway. Norway is not part of the EU. Norway basically follows EU law because otherwise they couldn't trade. And speaking to our poor friend over here in Brexit UK, that's really the problem that the UK has right now. If they want to trade with the EU, they're going to have to follow EU law. And that's what they didn't want to do in the first place, right?
Right. Absolutely. Which may be coercive. I don't know if that's a control thing or not, you know, like whether or not, because they could trade with Africa, right? They could trade with anybody else. Yeah. You know, like it's just a matter of like how much you want to, who knows? Because obviously they want that thing to be big. But this is beyond my scope of expertise, so I should shut up.
but I was just thinking about this subject of like, this more tribalist world seems more appealing. But then what happens when, you know, say these 50 tribes over here decide that they're going to become the United States of America and then go gobble up everything else, right? Then is it possible to maintain any form of...
Well, actually, I can tell, like, in The Way of Men, there's a theory that comes from a book called Demonic Males, and it, you know, it's just a generally understood theory, I think, in anthropology or whatever, with our species, is that we are a party gang species. In a sense, is that we feel most comfortable in small groups, but if there's a superordinate threat, we'll band together. And then as soon as the threat goes away, we'll break back up into, like, smaller groups. Because that's actually how we feel more comfortable, because you know everybody, you speak the same language, you have that familiarity. That's good. But if there is a superordinate threat, we all band together. And that's, you saw that, obviously, that happened in World War II. You have Axis and Allies. You know, like, and they break back up into what they are. And you know, I think that there's room to, it doesn't always have to be one forever.
Yeah.
You know, like, if Russia decided it wanted to be an aggressor, then obviously, like, the EU and probably the United States would have to get together and be like, let's make some boundaries and, you know, figure that out. And then obviously they would want to go back to self-determination, because obviously, you know, people in the EU wouldn't want the United States running them.
Right.
You know, yeah. And so, like, they wanted to go back to, like, hey, I want the people near me making the decisions about my life. And that's been a most frustrating thing about a lot of things that have gone around on around the world right now, is that you get a situation where, like, you have people that aren't near you at all making decisions about your life that aren't relevant to even your reality. And that's what I think self-determination is so important. Like, I mean, like I said, I lived in a town where I think like three people have died of COVID. Yeah. Like in the entire, since it started, you know, and so, but you know, same policies get put here that they get put in a big city, you know, and so you get, you know, like, there's, people get mad when they don't have an ability to self-govern. And so I think that's the thing that you have to go back to. I think after you band together to fight the big enemy, you got to break up into, like, smaller pieces.
Okay.
That's something I definitely agree with. I said it quite a few times that I would rather localize power and people who are the people who are passing judgment and are in control should be closer to the people that they're governing. Because, I mean, you've got Europe that is 700 million people, and it's impossible to put laws in place that are going to be perfect for every single person. I mean, there's three of us on this chat, and I'm sure we'll agree on some stuff, and there'll be other stuff that we'll absolutely disagree. So it would be impossible probably for us three to have a blanket rule of rules that we're all happy by. So when you start doing it to, like, millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, my personal feeling is that it doesn't work. And I think it should be, you know, power should be much more localized.
You know, as a Dane, this is like, this is music to my ears. That's pretty much what my country is built on, local government. And also, like, what you would call grassroots organization, right? So you have people with special interests over here, they all come together, and then they form a organization, a collective, basically, with a democratic structure. They elect a president, or whatever you want to call it, right? And that can be everything from, you know, people who want to protect environment over here, or people who are into model trains, or a badminton club, or a, you know, martial arts club. It's the same basic structure, right? And those groups, they on different levels, in to the extent that they need to. I mean, some of them have political ideas and aims, right? So they work together with local government, right? You have people electing city council officials, and to an extent, county officials. We kind of got rid of that, and then of course the, you know, the national parliament, right? So there's like a tiered sort of democratic system where you can start at the very, you know, bottom with the people who are locally involved with something, and then all the way up through have collaboration in different ways. A thing that I'm seeing here in the U.S. when it comes to this is people seem a little lost with these kinds of things. People don't have a lot of things that connects them. And I would say it's probably because of this, you know, superstructure that is, well, work, eat, sleep, fuck, die, right? Buy a Ford.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's all it is, right? so it's like you live in your little suburban house, but you don't necessarily have connections and community around you when you do that. That of course then detaches you from a meaningful engagement with for instance local politics. And there are some places that this happens, of course, that there are people who do that kind of stuff, but there's also so many people moving in and out of areas and territories in the U.S. that I think it becomes difficult to maintain a cohesive structure for a local community.
Yeah, we're remote, very mobile, and I mean I've noticed this a little bit because I got just a touch involved in local politics out here for a minute, and just got a sense, got to see what was going on. And this is a small enough area that we know all the people in town who are on the other side. they all know each other, and they're like, I know what restaurant so and so goes to, and I know what this is, and so they all know what's going on. And so there is some sense that they're all there together. But there is, especially right now, unfortunately, we all, the world as it was like a year ago is not even what we're talking about anymore. So there's like mass migrations happening all around the country right now. And so people are going to be a lot less grounded in their community because everybody's going to be new. Yeah. Because everybody's leaving New York and going everywhere, and everybody's leaving California and going everywhere. And I'm leaving the small town and going to Utah. And, there's a big migration happening right now. So we'll see what happens, in a few years. But actually, to say it'll probably stay as much the same as your point of like work, sleep, whatever. The push really is for everybody to work from home.
Yeah.
And so that as adults, most of the friends we make are through our jobs. That's the easiest way to make friends because you spend the most amount of time with people. And then you're like, well, Bob's a jerk. I don't want to hang out with Bob. but then you're like, but then Rick over here, he does, he's pretty cool. And so you get a sense of who people are. And that's how you make friends as an adult many times. And all these people, sitting at home in their computers, have a lot less opportunity, I think, to really connect with the people who are close to them. They're connecting to somebody who's in like Taiwan or like whatever through Zoom meetings and all that. Whereas they may not even know they're the person in the apartment next door.
Yeah.
Or the house next door or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's true. For the most part, for me personally, I live in a small enough town too, that we actually, interact with one another. So that's kind of nice. This is definitely the how it is in, the bigger cities, right? So I want to ask you, Jack, then, what about the individual? What can the individual person do here, find rituals for their lives? To become a functional man who is of a healthy mind and doesn't, for instance, get bogged up in in that aggression that seems to be part of our biology.
I deal with men, so I don't deal with what women should do ever, because that keeps me out of trouble, more trouble anyway. As far as what men should do always, I do think that we need other men, because I think that helps us develop as men, but that can be in a productive way or a non-productive way. And, to develop as an individual, obviously you're going out and you're learning more skills and you're testing yourselves in different ways. And whether, learning something new. I do think that for men, I think that there needs to be an aggression part, and maybe they would make less stupid, aggressive comments online if they maybe took some martial arts and got that out of the system. Find a more positive outlet for that. That's, more functional, and have that experience with other men and so forth. And I think that is you as an individual making a decision to go do that, but as far as for finding rituals for yourself and for your home and whatever, I mean, that's good too. You know, like, you know, it's obviously you have to set up your own personal life in whatever way that you want, decide what you really want to do in life and what your contribution to the world. I think that we are very social animals. So we have to seek out each other, and it's just a matter of who you're seeking out. Like they always say, like you're a sum of the people who you surround yourself with. And if you're angry and you go out and hang out with 10 angry dudes, I bet you're going to find some more stuff to be angry about. You know, like, you know, like that's, or they just, or men, and I've had this a lot, men seek each other out just so they can finally talk about the things that they're angry about. Mm. You know, like they had to be politically correct all the time, and then they want to find some guys that like, oh, this is some bullshit, isn't it? Yeah. You know, and then have the big talk about like everything they're mad about and get it out. And so maybe that's just catharsis for them. You know, maybe that's just cathartic, but I don't think that's positive. I think that if you're seeking out other people who are, you know, moving in a positive direction, they're going to influence you in that way. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm moving. I'm like, I know some people in Salt Lake City who are movers and shakers, who are getting things done, who are like, going to push me in a way and make me see the world in a different way and make me think and make me push myself a little bit. And so that's what I want to. That's what I think everybody needs that. You want to surround yourself with those kind of people.
It's funny that you mentioned about arguing online. I mean, I grew up playing rugby my entire life from 14 up until I think I retired at like 30. And I always got aggression out playing rugby. You know, it is, I guess, quote unquote, a masculine sport. You know, you definitely get aggression out. You have the occasional fight, and it is what it is. But when I stopped playing, I definitely found myself having more and more online quote debates and getting into just stupid little arguments. And it wasn't until then I started doing like jiu-jitsu, mixed martial arts, Muay Thai, where I found another outlet for that aggression that I then kind of calmed down a little bit again and stopped being such a dick online. I mean, I'm still occasionally a dick online, but...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have my moments, but it doesn't do anything. And so, yeah, I think if you have something else going on, and I always say people who are making angry comments online, I always imagine them standing in line at like the DMV or something. Like I always imagine them like being someplace they don't want to be, being bored and wasting time.
Yeah,
and I think that is a lot of where that comes from. And you know what? If you're busy and you're doing stuff that you care about and you're excited about, you're not online making stupid comments. You know, like you're absolutely. You know, you're invested in some other point. yeah.
So Mateus, I mean, we've kind of gone way off topic from the Viking Age.
Something
I mean,
about Vikings. Yeah.
Yeah. Quick, throw something in there, Mateus. I guess. The handbook, I guess, maybe to being a man is Havamal and the way they go through the different lessons. I don't know if you want to just touch on that and what that kind of shows us to being, on showing us about masculinity in the Viking Age.
Yeah, so some of the sort of like core aspects of being a good man is to be, self-reliant, as we have seen already. One of the stanzas says something like, the man who's a beggar has a crying heart or something like that. So it's like that's a very central aspect that you want to have your own, your own foundation for income and food, right? You want to have your own house, even if it's got holes in the roof, it says. Aside from that, a responsible man. A man who takes responsibility for himself and for his surroundings. That's something that we're seeing a lot. Havamal talks a lot about not getting too drunk at parties. That's a thing. Don't get too drunk.
Says me as I was just drinking a beer.
Hey, you're English. It's all right.
Yeah.
No, so that's a thing. That's really important to keep yourself in check. Keep your And keep your anger in check as well. It's also something that we're seeing mentioned. I think it's a little cryptic, the stanza, but one of the stanzas talks about how, you know, there can be like this strong fire of friendship between people, then all of a sudden it cools down and people become dicks to each other. That's a thing that we're focusing on a lot. Generosity is another one. A man who's generous is a more respectable man than the one who never gives out anything. But in turn, also a man who does not accept gifts is an idiot. So that's another thing that Odin basically is pointing out here. Finally, a man who wants to steal another man's property has to get up early. That is something that Odin also tells us. And you have to be friends to your friends, and don't be friends to your friends' enemies. So there you have the stress on the community, and the community of men, I would say. That's who he's talking to in this poem, right? Loyalty, courage, those pretty standard, I would say, pretty standard ideas of what makes a man.
It's fascinating how many are still so relatable today to mm-hmm. say that they were written so long ago.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. This is one of the things I personally find fascinating about, you know, Viking Age, pre-Christian culture. It appeals to exactly the kind of person that I am today. You know, it is applicable in my daily life. It also says somewhere in Howl-O-Mal, it says, "Don't argue with fools." Right? That's like written for Facebook.
I remind myself of that all the time. I had started comments, and then I remember that one.
Right,
like
right.
not three words with a lesser man. Like, exactly.
I definitely need to think of that more.
That's kept me out of a lot of trouble because it does, and because they it basically says like they'll come back and beat you at your game, which is another quote about that. That's more modern, but you know, like that, you know, they'll beat you with experience or something. But yeah. You know, they and another one that's made for you know, online discussion really. Is there are a lot of passages, I can't quote one specifically, but there are a lot of passages about, like, you know, being a fool who everybody you think everybody's laughing at with you, and they're laughing at you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And there, there's a lot of that in there, you know, yeah. Like, so, you know, like the, you know, foolish man thinks everybody's laughing with him, but they're really not, you know, like yeah. they're actually like, yeah.
No, that's true. There's also, you know, don't show up to a party, then sit there and stare at people and talk about them and la 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 la. You know, be happy, be courteous, be friendly, be nice, drink a little bit, and then go home and sleep. You know, you know, modesty is an important virtue as well, and that also means modesty with like. Who you are as a person. Don't give too much of yourself either. And care about your reputation. Right? There are two stanzas about that. What was it? 76 and 75 and 76? Somewhere around there. Those are the ones with like, you know, that you will die and your cattle will die and your family will die, all that stuff. Right, they right. end with, you know, what the one thing that does not die is the judgment that people have over the dead man. So that basically mm-hmm. means, you know, shit people are going to talk about when you're dead, right? That's what you need to care right. about. What kind of legacy yeah. am I leaving behind?
It feels like a lot of it is just do things in moderation, which is, I guess, you know, you can live your life by that now. It's just enjoy yourself, but just don't go too excessive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's basic old man advice. You know, it's like dad advice. You know, like, hey, like, you know, like maybe you should not get so drunk at parties, son. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like maybe stop running your mouth around a whole bunch of people because you're going to get yourself in fights. Trust me, I've been there. You know, like that's, I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, it's a lot of like, you know, guy, like an older warrior giving a younger warrior advice or whatever, you know, like don't get these stupid situations because this is what happens. you know, I know you think it's a good idea. You know, I know you think a lot of meat is good, but you know, maybe it's better in moderation. You know, it's not as good as men think, I think is one of the lines from it.
And obviously the 20-year-old knows best.
Right.
Always. Always.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course. One thing I do remember from your podcast together was, Mateusz, you were mentioning about how sort of it was, I guess you have this idea of Vikings as being very bloodthirsty, and if somebody wronged them, you would go around their house and cut them down and kill the family, and that was that. Whereas I know you mentioned on yours, Jack, how that wasn't necessarily the case, that it was more thoughtful than that, and you know, something may go wrong and you may go home and sit and think about it for 12 months and then come back and have your revenge.
That's typically how it goes in the sagas. You know, somebody offends someone else to the extent that this legally would merit that the person responded by killing either the person that had offended them or somebody from their family. And yeah, the next thing that happens is, like, you know, say you're out, you know, this is you're out plowing or harvesting hay in the commons, all of you from the same area, right? You have to, there's like the commons where everybody can harvest hay, and somebody ends up insulting someone else. Now, instead of that necessarily turning into a fight right there on the spot, the saga will typically describe it as like he looked sternly at him or something like that, and then he left. And then, you know, 6 months later, somebody from that family gets killed. All of a sudden. And that's how these things often play out in the saga literature. And I think, you know, one of the things that lies behind this is probably that the transgression has been done. The question is, what is going to be the response? And the response, if you want to maintain your position in this type of society, will have to be violence. Otherwise, I mean, you can take it to court, but then you're going to have to rely on, first of all, taking it to court will be once a year, but that would be possible, right? But you will also have to rely on basically popularity and alliances between the different families. And that can be tricky in and of itself. But if you have the law on your side, then it is your right to then go kill somebody from that other family, not necessarily the perpetrator. Now, that all ties into a system of status. So an offense and how offensive it is based off of like the status that each family holds. So if the family that the person that is offended or being targeted by some kind of offense comes from a higher status family, then there's a real problem. Like, then it's a serious problem, right? But if it's a lower status family, then it's not actually a problem. Then he just needs to shut up and go home. But then, you know, you also have to measure out the correct response, because like if the person from the other family is the highest standing individual and you then go kill that one, then you have a whole civil war on your hand. But if you go kill a slave, on the other hand, then you just basically messed with some of their property. If you kill a lower ranking member of the family, then it might be able to be settled with a whale guild scenario, right? So like, there are all of these things that you need to measure out and really, really be careful what you do, because you know each response or each action has a consequence or a response that will come back right in your face at some point. And that's also kind of like the basic morale of any saga or moral. But yeah, the point is simply that's how sagas usually play out. That's what they want to tell you, that you have to really think about how you respond to these kinds of transgressions.
Yeah, when I was listening to that, I was thinking about how that kind of shows to being a man and how it's not necessarily you have to respond, but you have to respond the correct way. You can't just act on impulse and pure hot-headed nature and, you know, kill the first person in front of you. You have to go home, sit, think, and then come back with a response. But like you say, it can't be too much of a response that is then going to bring more negative impact on you. It's got to be just the right amount of response where you don't lose face, but you've also got your own back for the original act. So there's a lot of layers to it, rather mm-hmm. than kind of you've killed so and so, so I'm going to come back with instant revenge.
Yeah, balance all the time, right? And make sure you got the backup from your community too. As a single man, if you just go out there and then respond without having checked with the rest of your family and other people who are important in terms of alliances, then you're a fool. Then you're a real idiot. Because that means then, you know, if you haven't cleared with somebody who's, say your family is very good friends with another family that is higher ranking or has more politics or something like that happening, and you haven't cleared with them before you go and kill this guy, there could be something that you didn't know about that would all of a sudden impact your relationship to that other family, and also then your standing in society. So yeah, it's a tricky, very tricky a situation to you know, exact revenge, and you never just want to do it. Like, you want to think about it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, having been in a small tribe for a bit myself, we think of politics as being on a national scale, you know, on this big, like, you know, people in big buildings and whatever, but politics is like 10 people. Mm-hmm. You know, you get 10, 20 people and you're like, well, these three people are on my side. These four people are on my side. Da, 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 da. If I come here and say this thing about this guy who's pissing me off, then I have to deal with those people and that people. And his wife is going to come over to my wife. Mm-hmm. I mean, politics is everywhere, you know, like in tribal groups. And I think that's just an example of like how tough politics can be, even with small groups of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
We haven't got as far as I was hoping we would do this episode, but I'm going to have to wrap this one up just for the fact that it's getting quite late here. And I mean, whilst we're on the topic of sort of masculinity, I guess the reason why I probably could do with the rest is that I'm going up to Scotland to lift a bunch of the original manhood stones, which I guess is kind of one of the original ways that they used to test, like we were saying before, you come in of age, and it's, here's a big rock, pick it up. Can you pick it up? You're now a man. So, you know, me and a couple of friends were going to go up and test ourselves against a bunch of these. So I need to make sure I get my beauty sleep.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
You've got it. I mean, quickly, this is the first podcast that we've recorded video wise, because we've just started our Patreon, Matthias. It's literally patreon.com/Nordic Nordic Mythology. And yeah, I mean, you can get on, there's a bunch of cool stuff that you can get for very little money. You know, we're going to do video episodes, bonus episodes, that kind of thing. So just check that out if you get a minute, just to help support us, and we can get some better equipment so I don't look quite as tired and shit. That's why I did my beard and sorted my hair out today. I tried to make an effort.
Yeah, no, I also did my makeup and all that stuff.
I did tell you to. I mean, apparently I can't sit here and just do the podcast in my pants anymore.
No.
So, no. Jack, thank you very much for spending the time. Thank you for coming on. Let people know where they can find you. Find your books, for anything you want to plug, shout out, what you're working on.
Cool. Yeah, my books are on Amazon. You know, the main one is The Way of Men. That's where you start. My website is jack-donovan.com. And I'm mostly distribute things through Instagram. So my Instagram is @starttheworld.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, hopefully people will listen to this and give you a fair shake and hopefully we can change a few opinions of the people have got.
Yeah, or not. Whatever.
Perfect. That's a perfect way to end it.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.